I love a lot of what Matt Walsh says. I love a lot of his content. It's funny. Like, his deadpan is hilarious. But then you saw his Dylan Mulvaney take, and that was the one that you kind of commentated on. And I couldn't agree with more with your response.
It wasn't loving. He was trying his best to hurt this person.
Why is the knee-jerk response, like, the parent's not going to accept them, the parent's going to be abusive? We assume the worst out of the parent. Why is that the first call?
I think that there's this narrative that, like, people want to kill trans people.
Educating children is teaching them how a group of Germans was told definitively to other another group to the point of mass genocide. And then that's education, is understanding how all of these tiny little drops in a bucket can create something so atrocious.
And in the education system, if you look at the history from, like, the Prussian army and, like, the Rockefeller and stuff, it's an obedience model.
You see everything that's happening with AI and how fast it's all developing. Imagine history class where you're able to kind of have AR, like an AR experience or a VR experience, and actually talk to Washington and actually, like, be a bystander on the lines of war.
Who's going to program it? Because you saw the stuff that's going on with, like, Google AI and stuff like that. Are they going to program it to where George Washington, like, "Hi, I'm George Washington. I am a slave-owning, terrible person"?
I would argue that men haven't known what intimacy is for a long time, way beyond the internet and way beyond porn.
Men were told not to have feelings. You're not allowed to have feelings. It makes you a pussy.
Hello, everybody. You are listening or watching Chatting with Candace. I'm your host, Candace Horback. Before we jump into the episode, just a little bit of housekeeping for the podcast. If you want to support the podcast, you can go to chattingwithcandace.com. Click that little link that says buy me a coffee, or sign up for our Patreon account where you will get early access to episodes and a chance to ask our guests some questions. I want to do a couple of quick shout outs for everyone that has bought coffee since the last time I've checked. So I want to say a big thank you to, oh my gosh, some of these are hard to read. Where's my mouse? I'm just going to say Loaded, Mark K a couple of times, Billy, Chris M, and Rich. Thank you so much. All of that goes right back into the podcast. We actually are doing an in-person show in a couple of weeks, so you are helping me out with that immensely. Thank you, thank you, thank you. What else do we have? Make sure you hit that like and subscribe button. It lets you know when I update. Obviously, I am not very diligent. It's not every single Wednesday on the nose. So for someone like me, it is wildly important that you have the notifications on so that when we drop an episode, you don't miss out. I think that's all of the housekeeping for the front end. Our guest today is William Rouge. We met on Instagram. He's an educator. He is a disruptor. And I'm so excited that we got to sit down for this conversation. I think it's worth listening to the end. It gets a little spicy. And it's cool because we have different lenses on a couple of topics. And I think it's a great example of how you can really be friends with someone and not agree on every single thing. And that is how really interesting friendships bloom and blossom and thrive. So without further ado, please help me welcome William Rouge. Will, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you. Do you like Will or William?
Will works.
Will.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll make a note of that for the intro. But yeah, I'm so glad we're finally doing this.
Yeah. Thank you for giving me, like, a chance to have this conversation. As we were just saying, like, I love having conversations with people that have different perspectives. And as if we can just talk about, you know, the school system in any way, I'm here for it. So
I know my team's like, you got to stop talking about schools and kids. Yeah. It's not what's catching, and we need to get you talking about relationships and sex. And of course that stuff pops off. But what is so ironic is I had this video go wildly viral, and it's me talking about parenting and, like, what to feed your kids. Yeah. It's at, like, almost 7 million views right now. And I was like, see, follow your curiosity. Don't, like, no one can tell you what to talk about, because I think what resonates more than any topic is just authenticity.
Yeah. And I mean, can't that all be kind of like, how do we do sex ed in schools? Is it done properly? Can we do it better? I think there's a way to link all the things that people are interested in. Why don't we do that at a younger age? You know, all these Tim Ferriss, mm-hmm. Joe Rogan, Chris Williamson, Lex Friedman podcasts, whatever. They're all, like, about education, essentially. But mm-hmm. no one's talking about the school system, which is supposed to be about education. So it just seems like a huge disconnect for me.
Oh, well, I am in the thick of education right now. So my oldest is 4. So we're still, I feel like I have this clock that says I have a year until we are really kind of getting into maybe kindergarten. And this is something to maybe ask you as well, which is there's this movement of delaying boys going to kindergarten specifically and how it's supposed to be really beneficial for them. So to hold off where you would typically do it at 5, you would actually have them do kindergarten at 6 instead.
Because boys like develop later.
They develop later and it gives them a chance to be, they say, especially for the kids that might be on the younger side, that actually putting them towards more a leadership role because they'll be older is more beneficial for them, especially with sports and things like that.
Yeah. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? I think that sometimes we can like kind of micromanage all these little things so much when it comes to like the right way to parent, or like if you breastfeed your kids versus like, when my wife had our boys, like we dove into that world of like, it's vicious about breastfeeding versus about like, people are so certain that this is like the right way. And if you do it this way, you're going to screw up your kids. If you put your kid in too early, I don't really buy into that. I've been teaching in them. I've been in the classroom for like 18 years. So I've seen kids from all kinds of backgrounds who were, it was done terribly and done perfectly. And it doesn't necessarily like align up as easily as we wish it did, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, like you want one causal factor. If I do this one thing perfectly, my kid is going to be happy, healthy, successful, all of the things. But there are so many things that develop character and success and resilience and grit, and not all of it, unfortunately, is in our control, or maybe fortunately, but there's this clip and this guy, it's this parenting I think it's parenting advice. And he's sitting there saying it's like the blank slate theory. So nature versus nurture. And near the end of the conversation, he says, so we kind of know now it is not a blank slate. It's about 50-50 from the data that we have. So open up a bottle of wine, pour yourself a glass and enjoy the best show on earth.
Yeah. I mean, that's gotta resonate with your children too. Are you like enjoying life? Are you stressing about every little thing? I mean, there's so many factors. It's not like, wow, you have an amazing 40-year-old child now. You know, you're an old lady, you're an old man, whatever. And then it's like, well, that's because I enrolled him in kindergarten a year late. Like there's so many factors. Every single day you can make good decisions and bad decisions. You just try and make more deposits of good decisions and then your bad ones as a parent, because we're going to screw up our kids in so many ways, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. No one's perfect. And I think it's also offering yourself grace in those moments as a parent, because if you're expecting perfection out of yourself, it's probably going to downstream affect your children, and then they're going to expect perfection out of themselves, and it's an impossible task. And I think the difference is to have that as the aim, knowing that you'll never attain it, but that's kind of the driving force for self-improvement, a incremental percent difference of growth and advancement every single day if that's possible for you. So it's not that you are expecting to achieve perfection, but just recognizing that you can always do better.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the idea of an aim. You said an aim. Like, I know you talk about religion sometimes and things like that. Like, I love the idea of like aiming for the ideal, but knowing that you're not going to achieve it, but at least you have a target that you can kind of work for. And you're constantly like, how do I be a better parent? How do I, nurture my kids more? Am I hugging them too much? Not enough? All of that kind of stuff. As long as you're just like conscious, that's a big thing that I try and do in my classroom, is just have my students be conscious. One of the things I tell them, Candace, is like, I would rather, I don't want you to cheat, but I would rather you go, I could look at my friend's paper right now. So should I look? I don't know. I know it's kind of wrong, but I need to get a good grade. If I get into college, it'd be good for my friend. So screw it. Yeah, I'm going to look. I'd rather that than just not even think about it and just look, or not even contemplate. Like, I just want them to be off of autopilot. And I see a lot of young people on autopilot kind of just going through life. And I want them to be conscious thinkers.
Unfortunately, that's what gets clicks though, right? It's the... No matter what team you're on, it's we agreed on this one ideology and we are just going to say that that is definitively the only way to live life, the only way to exist, and the only way to be successful or happy, and anything other than that is wrong. And we all want to belong, so we kind of just tend to go with these group identities. And one of the videos that you had sent was actually you talking about religion, Christianity, and you were using a Matt Walsh clip that I saw. And it's funny because I feel I love a lot of what Matt Walsh says. I love a lot of his content. It's funny. Like, his deadpan is hilarious. And he's definitely contributed, I think, a lot to opening people's eyes and how crazy some of the trans ideology is, with his, you know, documentary that he did with Daily Wire, that What Is a Woman? Mm-hmm. Awesome and necessary. Yeah. But then you saw his Dylan Mulvaney take, and that was the one that you kind of commentated on. And I couldn't agree more with your response, because I'm sure you can imagine I get a lot of the flack from certain communities, and that some of them are these really pious, holier than thou Christians, and they cast so many stones. I constantly feel like I'm in a modern day witch burning, and I can't help but see the hypocrisy, because I'm not a Christian. I believe in God. I'm a spiritual person, and people will laugh when you say spiritual, because that has gotten a bad rep as well. I don't think that you should be defining someone else's spiritual path or what they should believe, because if you are going to tell me that you are the only one that has God figured out, I immediately know that you're full of shit. But what I do know is that there are several countless references in the Bible, in holy texts, that are saying you aren't supposed to judge. None of us are perfect. So I don't understand how these people can get on their high horse and sit there and make public judgments around other people and how they're living their lives. Or in Matt Walsh's example with that video, just be cruel. Like, you can say a truth, and I think the truth is so important. I don't think that sugarcoating it is kindness or compassion. I think it's the opposite of those things. But I think when you use cruelty instead of what could be good judgment, I don't think even all judgment is bad. Like, judgment with the sense of improvement, self-betterment, trying to help someone recognize a wrongdoing, versus judgment to just dunk on somebody or be cruel or one-up or prove a point.
Yeah. I think the reason that bothered me is probably a similar thing to you, is like, he puts the label out there that he's a Christian speaker. He's a Christian person. And I am. I adopted Christianity pretty late in life. I mean, like a year and a half ago. I got like back to being an adult and stuff like that. It was a long process to get me there. You know, it's the biggest message. At one point in the Bible, they asked Jesus, like, which commandment's the most important one? He said, like, love your neighbor. Like, loving each other is the most important one. And what Matt Walsh does, I agree with you. I think it's important. I think there's a lot of stuff in trans ideology that's crazy. And I've had like 9 different transgender people on my podcast to talk to them, because I'm just curious, you know, mm-hmm. activists and like MAGA hat wearers and stuff like that, who are all trans. But, you know, it wasn't loving. He was trying his best to hurt this person. And that's that upsets me way more than someone who's not like a believer or who doesn't align with Christianity doing that stuff. Because again, I talk about the ideal. Like, I like being a Christian just because I like having like an example. You know, if I'm giving like a homework assignment to my students, I'm like, this is a project where you have to do a report on the War of 1812 or something, you know, and it's like, this is last year's report. This is an A+ from the best student ever. Aim for that. You know, and so I think that when you put yourself out there as a Christian, you have to try your best to live the way that Jesus said to live. And that was not what he did. But what did Jesus, you know, when I posted that, people were like, you know, Jesus flipped over tables and things like that. He was angry. Yeah, but with who? With the Pharisees, with the religious people. He went after the religious people way more than anyone else. And they said that he was wrong and blah, blah, blah. And they're the ones who killed him. So he had the biggest tension with the religious people. So, you know, that bothered me in a whole bunch of different levels. Also, if you do believe that these people who are trans, like Dylan Mulvaney, if you're going to say Dylan Mulvaney is sick, and you can make that argument, that has some sort of mental illness, some sort of narcissistic, you know, mental illness, whatever. You know, I've had like Buck Angel on my podcast.
I love Buck.
He's the best. And
yeah.
He says like up front, he's like, you know, I have a mental disorder. So if you say someone has a mental disorder and then you, in the next breath, ridicule them for having a mental disorder, I mean, pull that back, apply that to all kinds of mental disorders. That's really dark stuff. So I just wanted to call that out. I'm not on like Matt Walsh's radar or anything like that. But like, I think that just really bothered me, because it's going to pull people away from something that I think is really beautiful. It's been great for me.
Well, the one thing that I think differentiates some, and there are a lot of things that differentiate someone like Buck versus Dylan, is that Buck is Buck is just so transparent and honest and just himself. Like, he's not trying to push anything on anyone. It is like, leave me alone. I'll leave you alone. And we can both recognize these pillars of reality still, which are so fundamental. Where I think with Dylan, and obviously I'm not a doctor, so take this with like a handful of salt, but it doesn't seem to be the same thing. Like, I wouldn't think that Dylan has gender dysphoria. I think it's more narcissism, like you said. And I think that there's probably more sympathy for certain ailments, where narcissism doesn't seem to have any sympathy online. Because I don't know how much of this is within a person's control or not, and how much of it is conscious, but it kind of seems like a very Machiavellian kind of dark triad trait. Like, I'm just going to take, and I'm very selfish. And I think that's the difference, is Buck is just trying to be Buck. Dylan is trying to be famous.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fast track to being like called a hero. But we're seeing that in schools now too, just to transition back into education. Like, that's a real thing, is for kids who are, they might be on the spectrum. They might just be, you know, oddballs. Like, there's a lot of oddballs, and I love the oddballs, you know, they're fun. But it's like a way to, I'm not accepted. No one likes me. But if I take on this personality trait, then I am a hero. You know, Abigail Schreier's book is pretty interesting about that, about a lot of girls transitioning and the social contagion element. I was talking to a teacher, a friend of mine who's in Maryland, I'm not sure, man or woman at the school. Someone transitioned, one of the teachers transitioned, and then by the end of the year, they transitioned to the beginning of the year, by the end of the year, like five kids in their class, like fourth grade, five kids or something like that, like, were now like non-binary or transitioning.
Whoa.
Like, there is clear evidence to show that it's a social contagion element. Like, if you look at like the instances of like childhood transition, it's like a hockey stick. Like, it's going up a lot. So we have to understand what that is. It can't just be like, now they feel comfortable to do it. That's just an assumption. Let's get some science behind, some social science behind this. But that's a concern, because I had Chloe Cole on my podcast as well. I'm familiar with her story, but she. Yep. Was autistic and transitioned, and, you know, got a double mastectomy at like 15 or something like that, and then at 16 realized, like, oh wait, I'm not trans, I'm autistic. It's a terrible. I mean, the conversation, I was like holding back tears the whole time. It was such a sad story, and she gets no sympathy. Same way Buck, who was like a real pioneer, the first person to get top surgery in LA, I think he said, like the early 1990s, and now he's a transphobe, and now Chloe Cole, this child who went through this horrible traumatic thing, it gets no sympathy. Like, we're so different in the way that we apply empathy. This person gets empathy, but not this person. You know, like, this group gets empathy, but not that group. It's really weird. I don't like it. I'm just trying to have conversations, try and understand it more, and help people see that kind of stuff.
So is it really as bad as social media says it is in schools? Like, are kids, first of all, hearing this information, talking about gender as a spectrum, sex as a spectrum, gender fluidity, so you can be male this day and female this other day, kind of how Neil deGrasse Tyson talked about it. And then are they taking this in as fact? So are they hearing it, and are they believing it?
So I'm in like the, you know, Instagram world too. So like, I'm like, oh, okay, so this might be overblown. Here's why I don't believe that it is. I have a lot of people in my life that know I'm a teacher, but don't know that I have a social media account or a podcast or anything like that. They just know me as like Will, like the teacher. And they tell me these stories. I have like cousins in Massachusetts who don't know anything that I do online. And they're telling me about how, you know, their daughters are coming home saying like, is it okay that I'm a girl? I have friends that live in Long Beach out here who don't follow any of my stuff. They're talking about how their kids are in like fourth grade and reading some like book about their trans uncle and trying to, you know, get people to realize that you don't have to be a binary. So it's, I think it's a lot. You know, I think it's a lot. I think that kids are getting a lot of information from TikTok. And I also think that teachers, what it comes down, I think a big part of it is teachers are like a soft-hearted lot. Like, we're just like, we're school teachers. We love, you know, we're like all that kind of like openness, loving, accepting kind of personality. So if someone, you know, is going down that road of like, hey, I'm a part of this marginalized group, it just makes you want to accept them and hug them, you know, metaphorically, just like envelop them in like this like loving embrace. And you're scared that their parents won't accept them. You know, I've had kids whose parents abuse them and things like that. So you want to keep that from them because you don't want their parents to hurt them or hurt their feelings or anything like that. So I think it's like misguided compassion on a lot of teachers to just kind of let this stuff go, as opposed to just asking them questions about it. But I, I think it's happening a lot. I really do. And I don't know. I know what's happening like in my classroom, in my school, and then my friends' classrooms and schools. I'm in like different cohorts of like and groups and stuff like that of different teachers, and it's happening. Yeah, it is.
Well, with that, because that's a common argument that you hear. So they'll say, well, the reason that we aren't telling the parents that we changed the child's name or changed the child's pronouns is we're scared of the parent's response. I guess, why is the initial reaction that you're that not you specifically, more like the collective you as far as teachers and administrators go, why is the knee-jerk response like the parent's not going to accept them, the parent's going to be abusive, the parent is, you know, we assume the worst out of the parent. Why is that the first call?
I think it's, again, it's the narrative that's being sown about like the thing you hear over and over again. It's like trans people are being killed on the street. You know, trans people are being killed left and right. Like you break down even that data. New York Times, it was like a couple of years ago, and I can't find the article, but it's something along the lines of they were talking about all these rabbis were getting beat up in Brooklyn. And it was something like Orthodox Jews were being attacked in hate crimes 4-1 for against black people hate crimes in New York City and 20-1 for trans people. But again, it's like that empathy thing. I don't know. People just had like less empathy or sympathy for like the Jewish community for whatever reason. But I think that there's this narrative that like people want to kill trans people as opposed to just like, you know, like, well, you know, do your own thing or, you know, I don't know. I mean, there are going to be a lot of parents, I'm sure, who are upset with that kind of stuff, but I'm in Los Angeles. I don't know. I mean, I kind of see the opposite. I see a lot of parents who are like, check out my trans kid. Like they're really proud of it. But I think there is that need for protection. There was, you know, the author Glennon Doyle.
It sounds familiar, but I can't think of it.
I never read her book, but like she posted a meme. She's like a very famous author, but she posted a meme and it was like of a mountain lion mom, like growling, like snarling. And then a couple of her cubs behind her. And it said the cubs were labeled like LGBTQ children. And then the mother lion was like me. And it's that flip side of empathy. You know, it's like the empathy that you want to care for the ones who are helpless. That's why we have it in like our DNA, but it's also the mother bear. It's like, if this person's helpless, I'm going to be the most vicious thing you can imagine to protect them. So I think that the teachers take on that role of like the mother bear of like, I got to protect this kid because, oh, you're a marginalized person now. That means you're helpless. That means I need to protect you. Whether or not there's a real threat or not. I mean, you get mauled by the bear and you have no intention of hurting her cubs, but she sees you as a threat. I think it's something along those lines, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I guess to that, it's when do we start realizing that we're no longer in 1964? So we have Pride Month. There's a rainbow flag on everything, you know, pretty much all summer now because it extends. I forget who was talking about it last summer. They're like, why was it Pride Month? Let's just make it the summer of Pride. And you have 30% of the high school aged children now identifying as something within that umbrella of the alphabet. So is it still marginalized? Because there was this, I follow, I'm friends with Scott Barry Kaufman, and he, I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He is the biggest bleeding heart. He is such a sweet man. And he made this post of this high school kid, and I guess went by non-binary. And I don't know the circumstances. I didn't look into the story. Got beat up in a bathroom and died. And so the way that Scott's tweet went was, you know, just showing sympathy, compassion, sadness for this person. And kind of the way that it was interpreted by the internet was that he was saying the reason this person died was because of how they identified, and this person died in the bathroom. I guess the cause of death isn't known, so we don't know yet. And I guess this person also started the fight. That's what's being alleged. I didn't look into the story personally, but this was just through the comments. And someone else brought up the statistic. Well, if, you know, 30% of people are identifying as non-binary or trans or whatever the thing is, you can't automatically assume that the reason that the bullying is taking place is because of this anymore, because it is so prevalent. So at what point are we going to kind of recognize that culture is shifting and not necessarily put people into a victim category who maybe traditionally would have been there, but doesn't really apply anymore?
Yeah, it's a sad story. And it happens, unfortunately, like fairly often kids get beat up. Remember like 2 years ago, there was this whole push for like critical race theory about like, is it being taught in schools? So the way, if I can explain this, like it'll take like a minute, but like critical race theory essentially is, you know, starting law schools, essentially it's like these lenses that you put on to look at law to see, is there racism baked in the law that's not, you know, overt? So I always use the war on drugs as a perfect example. So the war on drugs was started with, you know, Nixon and John Ehrlichman, who was his head advisor, said, this is like a way for us to lock up black people and hippies and blah, 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 blah. So it's like upfront. And then you look at the war on drugs, you look at the way that sentences are pushed down. You look at the, even like Roland Fryer's work on how, you know, black people are pulled over more and harassed more and stopped more. You look at stop and frisk statistics in New York, all that kind of stuff. So you look at like, okay, so a lot of black people are being incarcerated. That was how it was intended, but it's just the war on drugs. But that's a good example of like how, if you look for racism in this area where it might not exist, you might find it. That's, I think that it's useful. I was on like Fox News and they were like, this is all nonsense, right? I'm like, it's not nonsense. It's a useful tool, but then what you have to do is you go, you put on these lenses, and then you take them off and you do some real data analysis in social science to see, is that true? You know, Michelle Obama, same way with this poor kid who was killed, but like Michelle Obama said, like she was at in line with a in a bakery and she had like a mask and sunglasses on or something, and a white man butted in front of her because that's what happens if you're a black woman in society. It's like, maybe that guy's just an asshole. Like maybe he just butts in front of people, but if you choose to see everything through this lens of racism or transphobia, then you're going to find it everywhere. Every time someone cuts you off, it's because you're a trans person. And you're just going to see all of these, like these bad elements, you know, racism and sexism and homophobia coming at you in all ways that you can't live like that. You're going to see the world in such a dark way. Maybe this kid was beat up because they were, you know, non-binary, but maybe not. But the headlines I saw on it, it was all like, Republicans are pushing this kind of stuff in Oklahoma. So it's like, let's blame it on the politicians, not even on the kids who beat up this kid. Not like it's just using this terribly tragic story as like a political tool. And that stuff really is annoying because we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't know. And if I was a parent and my kid, I'm sending my kid to be taken care of by government, right? Because it's a public school by adults. I'd expect my kid to come home safe, sound, without a scratch or some crazy trauma that they just went through. And the amount of bullying that happens is just insane. And it's inexcusable, but I don't understand. I don't know. Like, how is this how is this happening? You have adults that are supposed to be watching the kids and being able to intervene early, hopefully, and not to punish. I think this is where a lot of people get it wrong. Mm-hmm. It's, we are so focused on punishment. And I think it's interesting because you could kind of tie it back to puritanical roots, right? So when the Puritans first kind of settled here, virtually all of the laws that were established, the very first laws of the land, were to punish, quote, sinners. So it was anyone who wasn't a fanatic. And obviously most people, if not all people, were religious back then. There was a difference between the Puritans and the Christians. The Christians did not like the Puritans. The Puritans did not like the Christians because they thought the Puritans were like out of their minds. But the Puritans were the ones that established the law. And pretty much all of the laws were to punish people that weren't as fundamental as they were. So we have this like embedded, rooted, almost like hypnosis to punish rather than to teach. And I feel like nothing is really truly taught or understood through punishment. Like, yes, the behavior might be corrected. If I go to do something and you whack me with a belt, I'm probably going to stop doing that thing after two or three times. But did I learn anything? And do I actually want to change my behavior for a higher purpose? So to be able to intervene in these bullying situations, not punish the kid, but like sit them down and teach them diplomacy and how to have like conversation, how to get over a difference. And I think that we see that, you know, when the chickens come home to roost and you can't have people that disagree on anything to even sit across from each other, because then all of a sudden you're going to start duking it out. So it's, how do we fix the behavior on like a real fundamental level?
Yeah. So, I mean, but bullying's always existed. I mean, I don't know. Who do you know that wasn't bullied in school? I mean, it's crazy, you know, and especially like
the bullies.
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but even the bullies were probably bullied by their big brother or something like that. I mean, you see it when you're a teacher, you see like, oh, the bully's the one who really needs a hug. Like that's the kid who's really lost. They learn that behavior from somewhere. You know, it's really, really sad. The story of like these bullies that I've seen over the years, it's so heartbreaking. You know, it doesn't excuse their behavior, but it kind of explains it a little bit. But yeah, I mean, the corporal punishment thing, if it worked, we would do it, but it doesn't work. You know, it's just like, you know, hitting someone for hitting as a punishment for hitting somebody, just the kids see through that. They're like, that doesn't make any sense just because you're bigger and stronger than me. So it's a lot about, you know, feel, you know, the empathy of like, how did this make this person feel and stuff like that. But the teachers can't do that. The schools can't do that on their own. You know, like I have access to my students for 1 hour a day. You know, like at home is where they really are learning this stuff. And adults do all kinds of terrible bullying. Look at online. Look at the stuff you probably get. You know, like how is that their parents are doing that? Now, whether or not their kid sees the stuff that they might say, they know the who their parent is and how they deal with people that challenge them in some sort of way. So that's there's only so much I can do with my time with that student. So, you know, a lot of it falls on the parents, I think, when it comes to the way that they're treating other people. I mean, people treat other people terribly all the time. You go into Starbucks, people are like, I said 2 stevias, not 1, you stupid. Like, oh my gosh. But then again, you want to give that guy a hug. That crazy lady who's like screaming and blah, 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 and calling names, like, she needs a hug. You know, and maybe that's just because like I'm like a Jesus person now. I don't know. I always thought this way, but you definitely see through it so clearly, even with adults. You know,
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a bunch of toddlers running around having tantrums.
Yeah,
and their big feelings, as we call them in this house, like, oh, that person's having big feelings right now.
Yeah, and when you have kids, isn't that cool? How like you grow up? Like I have a 9, 7, and 2, and like my 2-year-old now. Like before too, he was like perfect. He was like sinless, you know, but now he's starting to be able to make, he's like a little bit conscious and you start to make decisions. So he's like, you know, don't touch the button, buddy. And he's like, he looks at you, he like looks at you and he goes, dude. And I'm like, what are you doing? But he does it for protective measures. He does it for, you know, what he sees as safety. He does it for entertainment. He does it for the same reasons why adults do terrible things. You know, it's like for, you know, they're scared a lot of times, or they're angry about something else that's going on and stuff like that. So you see a lot of adults just as like big kids.
I guess like the understanding of emotions too, and how that doesn't translate into adulthood, because again, it's like, you can't have these conversations without people getting wildly charged. And I'm in that bucket too. There's times where I can meditate and I can be self-aware, and then all of a sudden some user says something to me online and I'm like, raw, like, what is this? And I'm just roaring, and you have to kind of reel it back in. But I think it's like anything else, that you just have to do these stress tests, and the more that you just dive in and kind of flood yourself with it, it gives you an opportunity to get comfortable with that discomfort and then hopefully transcend it. Because I have not reached escape velocity yet. I still have to go into my comment section and engage for the sake of the algorithm. And I cannot wait until the day where I am beyond that, but I'm not there yet. So I have to go into the comments, and it is like a masochistic exercise every single time. I go in there and I try to respond. And sometimes I try to be funny. Sometimes I try to offer different perspectives. And then other times I go in there for battle. And it just kind of depends on the day. But I feel like the more and more I do it, the less I'm actually getting really riled up over it.
What's the goal for you to go in the comments? Like, what's the – is it just to like – just so the algorithm sees that you interact, really? So you could just go in and just like say smiley.
And it makes a difference. It makes a huge difference, unfortunately.
Because I like
go in?
I ask questions. I'm just – the whole thing is, I'm just very, very curious person. So like, I just ask a lot of questions. So if people come after me, I just lean into curiosity. Instead of saying a rhetorical question, I just lean into curiosity. Do you ever take an Enneagram test, Candace?
No, my husband is obsessed with Enneagrams. So I think he thinks I'm a 6.
Okay. I don't know. My wife knows that she gives it to all of her employees and stuff like that. And it helps her a lot for how to, because it has like their drivers and their pain points. So it helps you to kind of deal with them. But I give it to my students. I give them in like the political ideology unit, I give them a whole bunch of like psychological tests and then political ideology tests, and they make a connection. But I'm like an Enneagram. Now I forget. I think it's a 4. It's like the one that says the Enneagram tests are BS. It's like the one that's like, I can't be boxed in as like, I don't know. It's like the brooding vampire thing she makes fun of me. But like in that, I hate being misunderstood. It's like, I really don't like when people say like, you're not actually trying to be curious. You're not actually trying to have conversations. You're just trying to push your agenda. I'm like online, it might be a bot, but I'm like, no, I really do. Come on. And I send videos to people. One of the things I do, this is such a time suck too. I have like 3 kids and like 2 jobs. Like, I don't know what I'm, but I make like a, I get on my phone. I go, hi, I'm Will. I'm a real person. I might have like my kid with me or something like that. Like, I'm sorry if what I said hurt you or offend you, or you think I'm so dangerous to be, I shouldn't be around kids. Like, do you want to have a conversation with me? Let's jump on Instagram Live. You can reveal to 1,000 people or 5,000 people, whatever it is, how dangerous I am and how terrible I am. Cause I think it's probably a misunderstanding. So why don't we have a conversation about it? I've done that a lot, like hundreds of times. And I get, you know, like one out of every like 50 or 75 people like take me up on it. But most of them don't. Most of them are thrown off. They're like, oh, I didn't expect you to respond. You probably get
I get that once in a while.
You know, I was just
trying to
put it out there to get some sort of reaction back. They're looking for a human interaction, I think. They're getting looking for a human touch.
Yeah, that's really, that is sad. But again, that's not my business. That's not my responsibility. And there's this Mark Andreessen quote that he's said on a couple podcasts, which is, there's no orphans after 21. So yes, you could have had the worst upbringing. Life could have been dealt to you like the shittiest hand, but at some point, personal accountability is the only answer. So when we talk about, you know, the bullies, they need a hug, and you see that crazy lady at Starbucks berating a barista, she needs a hug. Sure, while all of that might be true, there's no orphans after 21. So get it together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And there is, part of that I think is compassion. I think compassion can be that really sharp knife and that powerful blow. It doesn't necessarily need to be softness. And I think what we have right now is so much softness. It's only the hug, and it's not recognizing what could be said as evil, malice, mistreatment, whatever. It's like, you can't approach everything with love or with softness. Cause I think again, like, to conflate the two. We were watching Einstein yesterday on Netflix. Have you seen it?
Mm.
It's really short, definitely worth a watch. So yep. Everything that he says in the movie is something that he has said in real life or written down. So there's nothing added, which is really a cool way to do a movie. And there's this one part of the line where he says, like, brute force can only be met with brute force. There is no other option. And he is a self-proclaimed militant pacifist. But he says, when it comes to someone trying to take over the world, because he's talking about Hitler and Nazi Germany, there is only one solution. And this is coming from someone who was very against any kind of violence. And I thought that was a really interesting quote.
Yeah. I don't know. I gotta... It's like, how do you get people to hear the hard truth, though? Like, I think they're so closed off to it that you have to find some sort of shared value. You have to find some sort of you have to see people the way they wish to be seen or something along those lines. Like, Candace Owens, I'm not a fan of hers, but like, if I would sit down with Candace Owens, and I wanted her to really hear what I have to say, which is like, my message to her would be something like, your approach isn't, you know, is like losing people that you want to try and get or something along those lines. I want to identify her as like, you're someone who is, you know, who is bringing, you know, black people out of the Democratic Party and thinking that they have to go along this way, blah, blah, blah. You identify her the way that she wants to be seen. So she goes, oh, yeah, like, that is who I am. Yeah, like, you're a pioneer for the black community. You're going to help them, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I am. And then you give her, like, you know, in teaching, if the kids be like doing something bad, you got to call the parents. You give them what they call like a shit sandwich. So you give them like, you know, your kid's great. They work really hard. They're a great athlete. And then you tell them what you actually want to tell them. And then you finish it up with like, they're going to have a great future, blah, 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 blah. So I think that I agree with you that we have to be able to tell the truth, but I think there's grace and truth. There has to be a loving element to it. Otherwise it's going to come off like Matt Walsh. And I don't think Matt Walsh is, I think he's just preaching to the choir. He's just going right after his base, as opposed to trying to bring people out of this very dangerous ideology. And that's why I think that the approach is sometimes more effective to like actually sit down and have a conversation. Why doesn't he sit down with Dylan Mulvaney, invite Dylan Mulvaney over for a lunch and have 3 hours of conversation? You know, who are you? Where did you come from? Like, take some time to get to know these people that you think are so terrible. I think it's a better approach. I think it's the only way that you're really gonna change hearts and minds, but I don't know.
Well, that's with giving them the benefit that's the aim. So the capture can happen anywhere, you know what I mean? And so for some people, I think the goal is to approach things with curiosity, learn, also provide whatever it is that you might be able to offer, different kinds of insight. And then there's other people that just want to be heard and be right and preach to a base. And those are two different things. So if you're going to be really polarizing and just be kind of a jerk online, you're not winning hearts and minds. To me, that says that's not really the aim. You just are trying to prove that you know something definitively. And those are different things. So I think what a lot of those people are doing. It's not to instill change or to really create a movement. I think it's just to be right.
I agree with you. And that's also in my world of education. That's why I'm going into it, trying to do something different. It's because I think teachers are the same way. I know I'm right. You know, I am right. I'm the teacher. I'm the sage on the stage. I'm the person who went to school for this stuff. I have a PhD or whatever it is. So I'm right. You can't tell me otherwise. And that's just, I don't think that that's a good way, a good thing to model for your students. So I think that I'm trying to model in the way I engage online. Like everything I've said online, I am fine with you putting out there. Everything. Because even if it is something ugly, which I don't handle myself great all the time, but even if it's something ugly, then I can use it as an opportunity to be like, oh, here's what I would do differently. Like, I think that that's way better for me, I think, in an educational setting. If you're going to be a lifelong learner, you're going to try and tell these kids how to think, not what to think. I think it's just a better option than what you hear about the education system all the time. It's just like it's indoctrination camp. And it is.
It is, because, and you see that, I'd argue it's even worse at some of the private schools, but how to think, not what to think, is so critical. And I know I wasn't taught that in school, because there was this really good example, and it was saying education isn't teaching kids about the atrocities of World War II and the Holocaust and having them memorize it and take a test. Educating children is teaching them how a group of Germans was told definitively to other another group to the point of mass genocide. And then that's education, is understanding how all of these tiny little drops in a bucket can create something so atrocious, and not just memorizing facts. It was like, I think originally when we had scheduled this interview, there was that clip that was going viral of this teacher that was actively doing an exercise of how to teach critical thinking to a student. And this kid had just kind of outwardly called J.K. Rowling a transphobe. He's like, knowing that J.K. Rowling is transphobic, and then goes on for his argument. And he kind of breaks this down step by step. And then it ends with the kid saying, actually, I didn't disagree with anything she says. And I don't think she's transphobic. It's like, why aren't we doing more of that? Why are we trying to tell these young minds that aren't done yet, this is the way of the world? And we have no freaking idea. Most of us are just trying to do our best. And it's like, given my experience in 34 years of life, this is my perspective. That's it. You know what I mean? Not like, this is the way.
Yeah, that video, Warren Smith is now. I reached out to him a lot because I was like, all right, let's go. He teaches at a community college, which is great. And but I think that stuff is happening more in colleges. Where it's not happening is in my world of like K-12 at all. And I mean, or if it is, it's not online at all. And you could see the reaction that, like, whatever, Elon Musk and all these people were like, oh my gosh, this is so good. They should be. It's like, yeah, I'm doing it. And I've made like courses for critical thinking in across the disciplines for high school classes and stuff like that. Like, I'm trying, but it goes back to what we were saying in the beginning, which is like, people just don't seem to want to, don't care really about diving into it. I don't know. It's like, it's a weird thing, but that went viral. People are saying, yes, teachers should be doing this. And then that's it. Like, and then it just moves on. I don't know. I'm kind of confused by That's why I reached out to you initially. It's like, oh, she's talking about the education system and about how, you know, we should be critically thinking and stuff like that. And like, yeah, let's go. So I think you're right to like, let's talk. Because I'm just looking for anyone that's talking about it and trying to like form some sort of like a Voltron or something to take on the Goliath of the way the education system works. I think the education system, if you look at the history from like the Prussian army and like the Rockefellers and stuff, it's an obedience model. It exchanges, what I say all the time is, it exchanges curiosity for compliance. Kids don't have a question. You go, sorry, I can't answer your question. We have to get to all these standards and stuff like that. We have limited time. So I'm not going to answer your question. So don't ask questions. You can't, some of the teachers at my school get upset with me because I say to students all the time, like, do you ever ask your teacher why you're learning this and how learning this calculus or covalent bonds or whatever, how is this going to help me as a 16-year-old in Los Angeles today, and then also as a 25-year-old starting a career in psychology, and then also as a 40-year-old, you know, mother of two? Like, tell me how learning about a covalent bond is going to help me with that, teacher. Go. And the teachers get really mad.
Uh-huh. I was that kid. Go to the principal's office.
It's so crazy to me. And I feel like a Twilight Zone kid is where I'm just like, so I'm the crazy one that says that the things we should be learning in school should be applicable. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. That's the crazy stance. It's so wild. I don't know. But you can't, like, because the truth is, you can explain it. Like, the War of, I saw the War of 1812. No one cares about the War of 1812. People know when it happened, but that's it. But you can explain the War of 1812. It was like Revolutionary War Part 2. And I explain it in like a, in a term like this, like, you just had a fist fight with a kid and you lost, even though you should have won, but you know, you slipped on a banana peel or something like that. And he won. Now he's being braggadocious about it. But now you have to sit next to each other in class, and it's October, and you got to stay next to each other in class until June. And you're stewing and he's braggadocious and you're like, it's going to get on again. That's what the War of 1812 was. So even if you win, don't think that the conflict is over. You got to really resolve it. That's a useful tool. But that's not what War of 1812 is taught. They're like, they burned down the White House. Andrew Jackson was a war hero and it happened in these forts. It's like, I don't know. I don't care about that stuff.
Well, I think all of education is going to have no choice but to change. I mean, you see everything that's happening with AI and how fast it's all developing. Imagine history class where you're able to kind of have AR, like an AR experience or a VR experience, and actually talk to Washington and actually like be a bystander on the lines of war. It's going to be really immersive, and I think, and then that'll probably be beneficial to a lot of people, assuming that they have access to the technology, I guess. That is,
who's going
to
program it? Because you saw the stuff that's going on with like Google AI and stuff like that. Are they going to program it to where George Washington will be like, hi, I'm George Washington. I am a slave owning terrible person. It's like, you know, that's the thing with AI is like, it's programmed by someone, and it's probably someone in Silicon Valley, someone with a strong ideology who doesn't understand the complex nuance of, you know, historical context.
You know what's weird too is I feel like a lot of people that are pushing a lot of stuff when it comes to CRT and DEI and all of that, they don't have kids. Yeah. And they're the ones that are trying to have the most control over your kids. So, I mean, it gets – again, my kid goes to a private school, and I feel like the benefit of that is that my opinion is somewhat taken into account. We've had meetings and things of that nature, so people kind of know where I stand on certain topics and what's appropriate and not appropriate. But even then, it's still wildly limited. And then I talk to other parents and they're like, well, we don't like this either, but it's the best option that we have. And you're never going to get something that's perfect unless you homeschool. And then there's this fallacy that you're not capable and someone else is capable. And it's like, why do I have such a deep disbelief in my own abilities or my abilities to outsource that and hire a personal educator? Like, that's also an option if you have the resources. So I'm applying for a school in the next couple of weeks, and I am so excited. I'm very hopeful to get approved, and we're just going to start school locally.
Yeah. You're going to start a school?
Yep. Yeah. It's a franchise. Yeah. And it's doing really well. There's over 50 in the country already. It's an Apogee school. So I will be submitting my application.
I have Matt Boudreau on my podcast. I love Matt.
Oh, really? Yeah. I'm so stoked. So I'm hopeful. I'm in the women's group. It's excellent. So we shall see.
Oh, that's very cool. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's what it's going to need is competition. You know, we know competition is going to create better options and stuff like that. You know, give people the care. The problem with that, so there's so many problems to try to solve within this like thing and work it out, is it's the parents who care enough to, like, it's not, what you're doing is not easy. So you care enough about it. And I don't, and even that, like saying care enough, I mean, it's a whole bunch of things. I mean, if you're a single mom, you know, who's work delivering Amazon packages and working at a diner, maybe you just don't have the time or the bandwidth and you have three kids and they're, you know, running around. You just can't, you know, whatever it is. Like, maybe, you know, we're in privileged situations where we have enough that, like, we have some time to focus on this stuff. But it's the parents who care, for lack of a better term, enough to give their kids a better option. What do you do with the kids who parents are absent? You know, I taught in East LA, like a really bad area, a couple of years ago, and parent-teacher conference night was very lonely. I'd have, like, you know, snacks out, water bottles, and I'd just, like, sit there and stare at the wall. So, you know, what do you do about those kids? That's what's tough about it. Because the kids who have parents who are advocates, they'll probably be okay. Going back to what we were saying before, like, this kid's going to be successful? Well, if they have parents that are active in their life, giving them attention, affection, boundaries, all this kind of stuff, like, they'll be okay. But the parents who are really absent, those kids, what do we do for those kids?
I don't have an answer for that. That's really tragic reality of it. Yeah. You know what I mean? That is that is really tragic. But again, it's the failure of the system, though. We pay money for this. So that mom that's working three jobs, she is paying a big chunk of her check and her time away from her kids that is supposed to go to this institute that is taking care of her kids. And then that institute is failing her and her children. So why is there no accountability? Why can't we say, okay, this needs a serious update? The world is changing faster than it's ever changed in the history of mankind that we know of. Why is the education system not adopting these changes? And why is it that, like, I remember when I was in school, I barely knew if my teacher was married or not. I would see a ring and, you know, if it was MS versus MRS. And if it was a guy, you looked for a ring. That was it. We had no idea about who they voted for, their beliefs, their personal life. And now it's become almost a requirement, it seems. And again, this is all on social media, because so I'm sure some of it's kind of blown out of proportion, or maybe it's not as prevalent as it seems. But it seems like a requirement that these teachers divulge their entire personality and personal life onto these kids. So you're supposed to be teaching them. I don't care how you identify, who you voted for, why you think the sky is purple. Like, you are here to teach, you know, like civics class, whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, there's a movement. A guy I've had conversations with, Corey DeAngelis, is like this movement of like funding kids, not schools. So go back to that, you know, single mom, is she gets, it could be a lot. It could be like $7,000 or more, like to just back cash that she has to use for like essentially vouchers, but she could, you know, do a whole bunch of different things for that, you know, buy online classes, get them into like a private school or something like that. I think there's something to this. There's like an argument in like the reparations kind of conversation too, of if you give like baby bonds to like kids who are like, you know, not just black kids, but like kids from like, you know, poor neighborhoods, if you give them like a government chunk of money that they can't get access to until they're 18, the idea of a financial literacy class, maybe they'll pay attention to it. Because if you give a financial literacy class to a kid who does it, who has the lights turned off every couple of weeks in their house and doesn't have food in their refrigerator, it's like, it's not applicable. I don't have money. I don't need to know how to handle it. But if I know I'm getting money when I'm 18, then maybe I'll be more aware of it. So if you know you're going to be getting this cash that you have to spend on education, maybe you'll be incentivized a little bit to dive into, you know, finding something better for your kid. I don't know, but it's an attempt. Let's try things. The reason why, to answer your question, the reason why things haven't changed is because the unions have gotten so strong. I mean, unions have a place. I think unions can be great, especially, you know, private sector unions, where it's like, let's get people better working conditions. The fact that I can make a decent living, I think the average salary in LA public schools is like $75,000 a year. It's not bad. That's thanks to unions. So thank you, unions, for making it a real job. But now, just like any union, that you keep moving the goalposts and you just protect, keep it, you know, boxed into this one thing and try and push down anything that tries to challenge that. And I think that's clearly one of the biggest hurdles that preventing the system from updating.
Mm-hmm. Well, then there's also the solution, which is what you and I were discussing at the beginning before we hit record, which is you're kind of leaving to go do your own thing. Because one of my questions was going to be like, how do you have a job? I see your content online. I was like, how's this guy not fired yet?
So that's funny. So two things. One is my wife, she's like awesome. She's a brilliant entrepreneur. She works really, really hard. She's a business owner. So she makes more money than I do. So that takes the financial burden off. And we're not wealthy, but like she makes like, you know, enough to be like, if I would lose my job, we'll be okay until I get another one type of thing. But then also I left public school when I started to see the writing on the walls with these culture wars, like right before, like as like the Trump thing was like building up. And I went to a modern Orthodox Jewish school. I'm not Jewish. I taught in public school. I taught in the hood. I went to this modern Orthodox Jewish school. And there's something in the Orthodox Jewish community that's like really focused on education and viewpoint diversity. It's like this thing, like old rabbis just argue all the time around the Shabbat table. Like they just like, hey, nothing's off limits when it comes to what are we going to talk about? And because of that, they've allowed it. So I've put stuff out there a lot and people find out where I work. I don't talk about it, but people find out where I work. They send letters that you employ a racist, sexist, homophobic, anti-Semite, whatever it is. And they just crumbled up and say, keep doing what you're doing. Because the kids like me, the parents like me, the administration likes me. So I'm like in this like kind of protected bubble. You know, I don't get poison ivy. It's weird. I don't get poison ivy, right? So I got plugged in my computer.
I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know that was an option.
Yeah. So I don't get poison ivy. So when I was a kid and the football would go in the poison ivy, they'd all be like, all right, Roosh, go in there and get the poison ivy. A little bit immune. So I think that there are teachers, and I've talked to them, there are teachers that agree with me on this stuff. There are. But they don't have the kind of privilege that I do of being at the school that I'm at, being in the financial situation that I'm at. So they can't. So they come to me and they sell me, like, thank you so much for saying this. You're going to be the mouthpiece for me. Here's a story that I'm going through that I wish I could say, but I can't. Can you say it? So that's kind of how I'm able to do this. So I'm very lucky to be in that situation. So I'm going to use it, you know, to try and bring awareness about what's happening in schools.
Oh, that's brilliant. I think that's the great thing, too, about all of these podcasts that are popping up. People get really annoyed or offended. And maybe that's just my feed. But people are like, they're giving anyone a podcast now. When my thing was going viral, I was like, first of all, no one gave me anything. I created this opportunity for myself. Second of all, it does have an impact. So there are people that can't share stories for whatever reason. And then you can kind of be the mouthpiece for that. And then also, if you're someone who is a curious learner and you learned something that week or that month and you want to share it with your audience, they might not have heard it. So all of these things have a downstream effect. And I think it's all important.
Yeah, but like that's just like that David Goggins thing, like haters, you're never going to find a hater who's doing better than you. Like, yeah, what do you care if I'm starting, like, especially if you have a good why. What's your why for doing your podcast? Mine is about like education and trying to bring viewpoint diversity and stuff. So it's not about really like likes and follows. It's not. It's about like pushing this idea. I want to fix education. I'm looking left, looking right. The reason I reached out to Warren Smith, I was like, is he a high school teacher that's actually doing this and can do it? Like, I'll just get behind him. I'll shut down my podcast. I'll shut down everything. I'll just be like, I'll help you, buddy. But no one else that I see is really doing what I'm doing. So I was like, all right, so I got to do it. But what's your why for putting up with all this?
That's a good question. And honestly, some days I really ask myself this. I sit by myself, usually in my closet because it's the only place that's soundproofed in this house. I have two boys. And I will sit there and I'll ruminate and I'll meditate. And I'm like, why am I putting myself through this? Because it is a lot. Why am I putting my family through this? Because it is a lot. And one of my reasons, because I think there's a lot of them, it's to try to influence curiosity, to try to present curiosity. And I say this a lot, it's curiosity without a conclusion. So I feel like we conclude so much. We think we know everything. Everything is closed-ended. And I don't think that most things are that way. There's so many different perspectives. There's so many possibilities. And if we approach things with a learner's attitude instead of I've got this figured out, then what a different place it would be. And trying to influence people to treat other people with humanity, basically basic humanity. I'm not asking you to agree with my decisions. I'm not asking you to be my champion. Just approach things with some humanity and humility. I've got plenty of that. And the internet keeps me humble, I assure you. Yeah. I will never be someone who thinks I am incredible and have it all figured out, because there are thousands of people to make sure that that's not the case. But and then also the idea of identity and the powerful force that is evolution. I think that – so Ray Dalio talks about this in his book Principles, that evolution is the most powerful force out there, and he uses nature as an example to kind of create his principles. So assuming that nature is smarter than we are through a vast amount of evidence, if I look to nature for answers to my questions, I'll probably get a better answer than if I try to come up with it myself or ask a fellow man. So evolution is one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful driver. If that's true, then someone like me should be allowed to evolve. And it's something I want to do. And one of the gifts of being in a previous taboo industry, which is the adult industry, is you evolve or you die. And that's the rule in nature. And I am just really faced with that in a very black and white situation. So it's, I can evolve and I have to do it against the current, because so many people don't want you to. It's like, you made this decision and it's permanent and you're forever a bad person. You're forever not worthy of a perspective and an opinion. Anything I say is kind of going to be suffocated by my previous decisions. And that's their way that they view people like me and the world, I suppose. But I have this obligation to evolve, kind of to hopefully trailblaze in some sense, right? You can improve your life. You can improve the lives of those around you. You can change your perspective. Hopefully you're a growing thing, like you're not stagnant. So yeah, I would say evolution, curiosity, humanity, kind of big things for me. But on a day-to-day basis, I think it's so important. And also more is caught than taught, especially as a parent. So to live a life that I think is worth living and to be a living example for my children.
Yeah, I mean, well, we're aligned in that. I have this thing of like, when you engage with people online, I made these like three pillars. It's intellectual humility. So you might be wrong. Genuine curiosity, like actually curious, and then grace. So it's aligned with a lot of things that you said. You know, when I saw your, people might not believe me, whatever. When I saw your thing on Citizen Podcast, I didn't know who you were. Uh-huh. So then I was like, all right, cool. Then I'm gonna have this conversation with this person or whatever. But then as you talk about like being in like the adult film industry, we can go into that or not. It's up to you. It's your show. But like, again, I see everything through like a biblical lens. Now I'm like a Jesus person. Like, but Mary Magdalene, who was, you know, like right there, like with Jesus, like right-hand person, like through so many things, you know, Peter too, but like, anyway, was a sex worker. I mean, one of the theories is that she was a sex worker before she was a follower. So, you know, if these Christians who are throwing this stuff at you, it's like, you don't have a right to have an opinion. You're marred for life. Mm-hmm. What about the person who was one of the closest people to your savior? Like that, I'm so critical of Christians, and it's a problem because I get really, really frustrated with it. But you know, this idea that you made these decisions in your life, even if you're still making these decisions in your life, people who are still in the industry, I don't know like your situation with that, but like it, who cares? Like, how do they treat people, and why is it your business? And if you want to say like, you know, that they're causing this horrible harm to society, okay, this one person is, or they're just a cog in the wheel. Like there's just so many things you can go into with like within that industry. I think it's, I just don't like the judgment element of it. And I think that, again, lean into more curiosity of like, what's going on? What are your takes on this? Because a lot of these people are casting these things while they're probably watching it at home, you know, and they're funding this stuff. So all that hypocrisy, I don't know. There's just a lot to that.
Yeah. So Candace Owens had I think she was a porn star. I recognized the girl's face, but I don't know her name or her story, but like she was a quote sex worker, and they had a sit down, and this poor woman, like you tell, she was very nervous. I mean, you're going against a juggernaut. I have my disagreements with Candace Owens, but I mean, she is as sharp as they come, and she knows her stuff, and she's a professional, right? And she didn't get to where she is because she's a dummy. So you were going against Goliath. So this girl was nervous, rightfully so, and was trying to prepare and had been studying the Bible, which I think is so respectful that she's trying to understand Candace's position and approach the conversation with both where she thought it was going to kind of go. And Candace is kind of sitting there smugly, and she's like, I wasn't going to even bring up the Bible because I would assume that you haven't studied it. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like, what is the point of this? And this woman is trying to bring up Mary Magdalene, which is an interesting thing because it is pretty much perpetuated that she was a sex worker. So it's like, it's not to accept the quote sin or the act, but it's hate the sin, love the sinner, that kind of mentality. So yeah, you can hate what I do, you can call it sinful if that's your perspective, but the whole point is to love the sinner. And that's kind of what was supposed to be absorbed from Jesus's teaching, and that's a clear example of how it's not. And she was on the Whatever podcast, and she was talking to this young girl who's obviously young and dumb. We're all young and dumb. That you're supposed to make mistakes so that you can learn. You learn from your mistakes. You don't learn from your successes. You learn very little from success, except for this is awesome and this feels good and I want more of it. You learn a lot from mistakes. So you're supposed to be young and dumb for a period of your life. And Candace is going, you know, toe to toe with this girl who does not stand a chance, right? Like me, even now, I wouldn't stand a chance. She's brilliant. Me at 21, I'd be floundering. And she's like, I'm just so curious about whole life. And I'm like, what are you doing to this girl? Like, is this necessary? Is that absolutely necessary? You know who was curious about whole life? Was Jesus, right? And Jelly Roll has this great great clip from a podcast he did. He's like, Jesus would have been coming in on a Harley. What are you talking about? You know, he was the man of the people and a man of the misfits, and no one is below redemption. And I think that's what's getting lost.
Yeah, there's two quotes I really love. One is C.S. Lewis. He said, the church is a hospital for sinners, not a museum for saints. And then the other one is a R.C. Sproul quote, where it's like, Christians have no reason to be smug. And an evangelist is just one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. I love that stuff. Like that's the, even like when I say I'm a Christian, it gives me like icky feelings about the thing that is the most important thing in my life, because it's so associated with that kind of judgmental elements of people. And I think they're missing the boat, and I'm new to this stuff. I haven't been like studying the Bible my whole life at all or anything like that. But I think I get the big picture. That's what I do with my history classes and stuff like that. My civics classes, I look at big picture. I look at big patterns. You know, I don't know who the 22nd president was. You know, kids will ask me all these like detailed, what was the Wilmot Proviso in early America? I was like, I don't know, kid. Google it. I don't know. But I can tell you like big sociology, evolutionary biology, like patterns. And that seems to be a big pattern of Christianity that the people who are experts are missing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. And I think especially when it comes to a lot of these religions. So are you familiar with like the popular male archetypes? You have the warrior, the magician, the king, and the lover.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
Oh, let me see if I can find this book really quick so I can reference it. It's really good. My husband's been reading it. I've heard it from a lot of people, and I'm on the lover chapter right now. Let me see.
My Enneagram 4 is probably like, I'm none of those things. You can't categorize me.
So here's the thing. It's similar to the female archetypes. It's to be able to know your field of play and be able to channel that archetype when it's necessary. So all of the things are integrated. So you don't exile any part of you. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of what religion has done, and even society at large has done, is expect you to kind of exile certain parts, or to say certain parts are bad and not be a fully integrated person. So it's called King, Warrior, Magician, Lover, Rediscovering the Archetypes of the Mature Masculine by Robert Moore. Highly recommend it. So when it comes to the lover archetype, so you have your mature and immature, just like you have light and shadow if you're into Jungian psychology. So you have this lover that is, it's the seat of creativity, of passion, of the arts, of obviously of sex. And he kind of he says these are all one and the same thing. The mature lover isn't saying sex is bad, isn't saying that art is bad or innovation is bad. It's just knowing the limits, knowing your personal limits. The immature version of the lover is kind of that hungry ghost that's never satiated and is consume, consume, consume. And then that is the theological origin of the word whore. It has nothing to do with sex. It has to do with being a bottomless pit, being a taker, being someone of no contributing value. So we associate with whore because it's easy, it's sexy, and it applies to everyone, because sex is a natural function of humanity. But when it comes to porn specifically, why I'm so focused on the lover chapter, it's I see this exiling of sexuality. So instead of saying, how can I integrate this in a healthy way? How can I control my compulsions? How can I have a healthy relationship with what is a fundamental human need? You cast it away entirely and say all of it's shameful or sinful. And I tend to be the scapegoat of that. And people like me tend to be the scapegoat of that. So you have the idea and the origin story of what is a scapegoat. Well, you would have the priest come in and you would have the two goats. And one goat would be told, both goats, I think, were told all of the sins of the community. And one was slayed and the other one was sent out into the woods. And it was thought that by sending this goat into the woods, there was this demonic creature that would then kind of take this goat. And in that would cure the community of the sins. So it's not transcending. It's your scapegoating people like me and the industry at whole. Instead of saying, okay, how can I integrate my own sexuality and come up with rules for me, my home, my relationship? And instead, it's no, this entire thing is wrong, evil, immoral, and you are the reason for the crumbling of society and social mores as we know it.
So they slay you, they kill you to kind of like try and write that.
Well, I feel like it depends on the person. Some people are trying to do basically a virtual witch burning, and then other people are demanding I go into exile, which is why it's so triggering that I have a podcast. They're like, you shouldn't be out here. You should kind of take your loss. You've done something unforgivable, and you belong in the woods with the rest of the dark things.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know. I can't imagine what the kind of stuff you get. Why isn't this stuff should be taught in school, right, Candace? Like, these different archetypes, the Enneagram, you know, whatever, the Myers-Briggs. Like, I can't tell you how many students, they're seniors or they're juniors or something like that. And I'm talking to them of like, what do you want to do next year? I don't know. College? Oh, what do you want to major in? I don't know. Well, what do you like to do? I don't know. You don't know what you like to do? No. Mm-hmm. Well, what did you do last Wednesday? Watched Netflix. What did you watch? I don't know. Would you have a favorite show? Like, the kids aren't they're just constantly consuming media and things like that, and they're not contemplating, you know, who they are, who they want to be. They're not thinking about that kind of stuff nearly enough, and I think that would be a great thing to add in schools. But they say, well, there's an opportunity cost. If you're doing that, then you can't teach them, you know, physics, or you can't teach them algebra. It's like, yeah, maybe you can't, but they'll learn algebra. You can learn algebra. If you have a reason to learn algebra, you can learn it pretty quick. You know, like, I don't know how to, you know, do certain things with like plumbing, but as soon as the pipe bursts, I'm figuring it out pretty quick. Like, people are resilient in that way, but what we're not teaching them is really this self-discovery of who they are. There's a lot of people who go out there and they don't know who they are, which is another problem with that is then you're not going to see your blind spots about why are you lashing out at the barista at Starbucks or some woman online who has a podcast, because they're not even aware of themselves and what their trigger points are and things like that.
Yeah. And I think I also represent someone who didn't get what I was told I was supposed to, which is punishment and a failed life.
Yeah. Oh, you're happy. You're married. Yeah. You live a nice suburban life or something. Like,
yeah.
No. Well,
yeah.
Cause we teachers say, like, if you do this, then you're going to be a loser. So don't do that. Cause you're going to be a loser. You know, like you know, Chris Rock says, like, keep your girl off the pole. Like, yeah, but maybe that's not the case all the time. You know, it's like, is it the ideal? Maybe not. But again, like you said, like, people from abused households become great. It's not that hurt people hurt people. I think maybe for children, little children, like, if there's a 4-year-old who's really terrible, it's probably because he was hurt. But like, for adults, that's not true. Hurt people hurt, but some hurt people help people. It all depends on how you deal with it. So I don't buy that at all.
Yeah, and it puts me in a weird position because I'm not an outspoken person to promote the industry at all. My advice almost all of the time to anyone is don't do it. It is, the cost of doing it is massive. Even if you figure it out, even if you financially figure it out and you somehow end up on the other side better than you got in, it is still a massive cost. And it's not easy to deal with those ramifications, and your family has to deal with it, and then your kids are going to have to deal with it. And it's no joke. It's no joke at all. But I also am really grateful that I did do it. Like, I wouldn't take it back. Yeah. So it sounds hypocritical, but for me, it's a really weird thing that I still kind of grapple with, because everyone's like, if you had a daughter, would you want her to do it? Absolutely not. And that's the honest answer. Absolutely not. I wouldn't want her to do that. But I also don't want to be the type of parent that's controlling my kid. So I'm going to love my kid no matter what. I'm going to support decisions as long as they're not inflicting harm on others or themselves. And it's a hard thing. It's you have a tree that's going to grow up to be an oak tree, no matter what you do, it's not going to produce apples. So I just feel like that was part of my path for that time in my life. And it wasn't easy. Right now, dealing with it isn't easy, but the amount of freedom that I've gotten and like the type of life that I'm able to live, the person that I've become because of those trials and tribulations and continue to be, it's supposed to be.
That person. Like, I drank a lot in my teenage years and stuff, like a lot, like I partied a lot. And, you know, it's like, would you want your kids to do that? It's like, no, but I like where I'm at now. I have a very blessed life, and I don't know if I would have been here and developed the way that I am if I wouldn't have had that. So it's so hard. Like, that's why regret is so tricky, like, to really go back there. Can I ask you another question about the
– Yeah, sure.
I had a woman who was a former stripper on my podcast, because I was like the the whole thing is like viewpoint diversity. So it's like the taboo world of stripping. And she was saying that a lot of people, it's like the ones who get through it okay, they know the deal more. They like can compartmentalize it. They see it for like what it is this way, as opposed to other people see it this way. Some people just like, is there like a way that you can frame it when you're, for like the girls that are in it, in that world, like you can frame it. If you think about it in these terms, you're more likely to come out of it like more yourself, or come out of it ahead, as opposed to like being like crushed by it.
So yeah, it's probably going to be oversimplified. But for me, one of my rules while I was filming was I was never going to do something strictly for money. I would have to actually be okay with the act. And I think that's so important. I think there's a lot of performers that get paid more to do more extreme things. They get more bookings the more extreme that they are. And then you also go get more views. So it seems like you're promised more success if you have no boundaries and you're just willing to do whatever is presented to you when you show up on set. Mm-hmm. And when I saw those performers, I got in kind of old, actually. I got in when I was like 20 or 21. A lot of girls get in right at 18. Those couple years, boy, do they make a difference. I'm a big advocate of raising the age to 21, even 20. It's too young. Imagine getting in at 18 right now. And it's so easy because now all you have to do is sign up for an OnlyFans account. Like, you don't, the way that I did it was the last of the old school. I had to find a company online. I had to look them up. I had to find their contact. I had to send in pictures of my ID. I had to talk to someone at booking. I had to fly down to Florida. There were so many steps before I did my first scene. And I was older, so I was able to kind of figure it all out on my own. But imagine being 18 and just signing up for an account, making that decision now, and then 5 years go by and you're like, shit, what did I do? And the internet is forever. At least right now, the internet is forever. And there's nothing that you can do. And then that decision is going to kind of cascade and have a permanent stain on your persona for the rest of your life, theoretically.
Yeah. 18 young. Like, they're is that like connected with some sort of pedophilia slant? It must be, because I teach 18-year-old girls. They obviously look, like, I frame it.
They look young,
kids, but they still are. They're children.
Yeah,
they're really young, and even like their bodies aren't fully developed. Like, it's like this. I don't know. It feels really creepy to me.
Some men like younger women, and that's kind of always existed. I think that there's
makes sense. Younger makes sense, but not
when I say. Well, I should say. Know, under 18, kids, adolescents, young adults. Well, I guess not adults, young people. So they did this poll and it went really viral. It was on Australian men, I think, and maybe it was done in Australia or New Zealand. But they did this study and it was something like 1 in 6 men had a physical attraction to 13 and under. And I had this psychologist on and we were talking about it. And the statistics are crazy. If anyone's listening to this, check out the Alex Psych podcast, because we get into like the exact specs and I don't have them in front of me. It was an alarming amount of men that were attracted to and acted on. And I asked, is this new? Is this something that's happening because of the internet, because of tube sites, because of you name it, like what's happening? And he says no. And his opinion to surmise it was, this has always existed. It just kind of went hidden. And now people have these surveys and they're answering it and you can see how prevalent it is. And that's why it's so important to protect your kids and be aware if they have any behavior changes or if they seem to start getting quiet or be distant. And you just have to have your finger on the pulse because it is a staggering amount and it's probably always been kind of high. So that, to answer your question, I think that's probably catering to a certain specific group of people. But I think to end up okay on the other side, it's you have to know why you're getting in, or at least get in for a real curiosity, not because you think you're going to be famous or successful or rich, because those things are really unlikely. For me, there was a huge X factor. I felt pulled to get in, and I don't know that that's a great reason to get in, but it was really powerful for me. I wanted to explore sexuality and femininity, and I idealized people like Pamela Anderson and Carmen Electra and Tara Patrick, and part of my path, I think. But for me, having strong boundaries, not doing things just for money, not getting involved in drugs and alcohol, I think is huge, because I think a lot of these women would do things for money that didn't feel okay, yeah, and then self-medicate, and it kind of became a vicious cycle. And then you, on top of that, you don't have a social support system when you go home, and then you have society telling you you're a terrible person and you're irredeemable, and these things kind of compound and can become overwhelming. And if you don't have the mental fortitude to deal with all of this, it can possibly lead to really dire consequences. So again, when people are like, if you had a daughter, would you? Absolutely not. I know how hard it is, but if I worked on an oil rig, I wouldn't want my right. son to do that. So same thing. I think the idea is that you want your kids to do better than you did, right? This is my story. I hope you did better, that you do better than I did, and that you are wildly successful and you're presented opportunities to follow curiosities and authenticity in a way that you're safe and full of life.
Yeah, but that's the rub though, right? Like, you seem really cool, Candace. Like, would you be this way if you didn't go through that? Like, I went through a lot of hardship. I was sick when I was older and I had all these crazy things. Like, so you want your kid to have an easy, beautiful life, but you want them to be awesome adults. And most of the people you know went through all kinds of crazy trauma and hardship. So like, that's the tough thing about raising kids is like, you know that if you bubble wrap it, everything's good, that they're going to be, you know, like weirdos or not have a lot of substance. I made a video about porn being dangerous, because what I see in high school and with a lot of boys and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Was there anything on that you felt like I was lacking nuance? I'm sure there is. Like, anything that you think it was lacking nuance or shows my ignorance in this issue. Do you remember what it was?
I don't remember the exact content, like the whole thing, but I remember feeling like it was very causal. Like the statement was very causal, that porn is the reason that mm-hmm. maybe attention spans are low, or maybe that sex, like the way they're approaching sex and relationship is different, and that the way that they might be treating women, young women, is different. Because there are studies that do show that people that watch more pornography don't recognize consent the same way as people that watch less. So I'm not saying that they're committing assault by any means, but I'm saying usually there's nonverbal communication that will say, I'm okay with this, I'm not okay with this, or too much in some level. And they're not recognizing that nonverbal cue. But that translates beyond porn. So they've done this study, and it's just screen time in general. So if they're spending that time on Instagram or TikTok the same amount that they are on porn sites, presumably that nonverbal communication would also be just as difficult for them to read. And then you have the conversation of consent and what is supposed to be safe consensual sex as well. And I don't think – well, I know that that's not the job of the porn industry. That's the job of the parents. And this goes back to sex ed as well. And it's – should it be taught? How much should be taught? And what is the job of the educators? Because this is a discussion for home. But also on the flip side, there are societal ramifications if a kid isn't taught these things. So then school does have some kind of obligation to make sure that the basics are taught, because if you're a 16-year-old girl and you get pregnant, that is going to affect her and her baby and then the grandbabies. Like, that has a really big, powerful impact on not only her, but her lineage and the community at whole if that becomes a problem. So yes, I think sex ed should be taught. I think the parents need to be in the know as to what is being taught and be okay with it, and just be able to pull their kid out if they don't want to and say, I'm going to supply my own education at the house. But also, parents need to get rid of their own shame around that conversation, because why is that an embarrassing topic? So this goes back to
sex talk,
right?
I didn't get sex talk. My wife didn't get a sex talk.
You didn't get one?
No.
By your school or your parents?
No, I got one by my school. No, by my parents.
Okay.
It was uncomfortable. You know, I get it. But like, we already gave my 9-year-old the talk. Like, I don't, because we don't want there to be like a taboo around it. But yeah, the sex ed, you know who Esther Perel is, right?
Love Esther, yeah.
So great. And she talks about the importance of intimacy. And that's the way mm-hmm. sex ed is taught, like plumbing, she says, which is so good. It's like, this goes in here. It's like, that's what you don't need. But that's what shows up a lot in porn too. I mean, I don't know, maybe there's different, like the kind of pornography that like women watch compared to men watch or something like that. But like mm-hmm. something about intimacy seems to be lacking in that too. So it becomes this act, as opposed to some sort of like emotional bond. And I worry about that for young people who are trying to go out there and just like, why not have sex? Like, I don't know. And it does promote like this. I don't know if pornography does it nearly as much as even like the show Friends. High schoolers love Friends, which is weird because it started like 10 years before they were born. But like, you know, Monica goes out on two dates and then she has sex with a guy. And then Joey sees a cute girl and they have sex. It's just like this casual sex thing. And I don't want to shame people when it comes to sex, but I again, don't think it's ideal to have, you know, casual sex be like the norm. I think that the ideal would be you find someone that loves you and you find a bond and then you have it. Like, that's the ideal. So again, why don't we aim for that? And then you're going to screw it up. But like, I worry about that element. And I think you're accurate. Cause I think I even said something like, you know, porn has a lot to do with like the ills of society, which is a sloppy way to put it, where it's,
yeah. Well, I mean, you could argue that Disney is a problem for young girls to watch too, though, right? So it's this idea that this man is going to be absolutely flawless and save you and be the reason for your existence. And that's not true, and that's not fair to men. Or that The Notebook is setting up men for an impossible standard, just like porn is setting women up for an impossible standard. It's supposed to be a piece of entertainment, and if someone else can't figure that out and is taking that into their day-to-day life, like if I were to go berate my husband for not being Ryan Gosling, that's my problem. That's not The Notebook's problem, and that's not his problem. That's me, because I'm bringing entertainment into reality. And I mean, I grew up before tube sites were a thing. Men, young boys were having sex casually without any idea of what intimacy is. Mm-hmm. I would argue that men haven't known what intimacy is for a long time, way beyond the internet and way beyond porn, because men were told not to have feelings. You're not allowed to have feelings. It makes you a pussy, right? So that's a way bigger problem than porn. It's just how we treat men as inhuman and somehow beyond feeling, which is not okay either. And then there's the flip side of the problem with sex is only supposed to be with love. And it is like this thing that cannot be separated from value and marriage and love, because that's how I was raised. And that meant the first boy that I had sex with, that was a huge thing. I lost a piece of my, and I was with him for years before we had sex. It wasn't quick. I was very shy, never physical. I was like 16 or 17 the first time I did it. And it felt like I had given my value away. I knew that this person wasn't right for me, but now that was it.
That's
now
I have the message that was sent to you though.
Yeah. Right. Yes. And now this is the person I have to marry, because now I'm not going to be valuable to another man, or this is such a big deal. So it made it harder to leave that relationship, where if I was taught that sex is a complicated thing and it's incredible if you have a real connection with someone, it is spiritual if you are within union and you love that person, or even if you're in a really deep connected space with someone, you can be connected when you just meet someone. And sex can be spiritual, it can be frivolous, it can be junk food, it can be whole and healing. The experience depends on who you are, who you're dancing with. So to say that it's only this one thing can be pretty dangerous, especially for a young woman, because if she does the act, gives this virtue away to someone, it's like, well, now what do I do? What cards do I have left to play? Instead of saying, okay, I did this, he's not right for me, I'm still worthy of love, and I need to be able to leave a bad situation if needed.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to what I'm saying. Like, you aim for the ideal, though, and then when you miss, which we're all going to do daily, hourly, mm-hmm. is miss it, then it's like, all right, well, I'm going to get back on trying to – at least you have, like, the guardrails. That's what Christianity helps with me with, is, like, I'm mm-hmm. off. I screw up all the time in so many ways, and then it's like, all right, well, I'm not going to do that again right now. So I'm going to get back on the path, and then I'll go down a little bit, and then I'll screw up. But, you know, even like talking about this, I don't know how many people in like TeacherGram world, like internet teachers, they show like, this is my bulletin board, or like, isn't it funny when a kid asks the same question twice? They're not talking about pornography, but their students are consuming it constantly, because every high school boy, anyway, probably girls too, you know, have a laptop and they have their room and they just lock themselves in their room, and it's just access to it so easy. It was hard. I'm 41. It was hard for me to get like access to like see boobs. It was hard. Mm-hmm. Like, you have like a lookout at like Barnes and Noble, and then one kid would like grab it, put it inside of another magazine, and then would be like, oh, God, check this out, or would like uh-huh. steal one from their older brother. So it was like a big deal. And now it's like, it's just ubiquitous. And I don't know. I don't know where it seems very new, like how much access to like, mm-hmm. and it is getting, as you said, like it's getting more and more extreme too, because you got to like one up. You know, it's always like they got to one up this person and stuff like that. I am concerned about it, But I'm trying not to be judgmental of saying like the people who are doing it are bad people, or even the people who are producing it, because they're just meeting a demand that people have. But I do have concerns about it in society. I don't know, because I think it's kind of uncharted to some degree about the way that it's just everywhere. You're just inundated
the volume.
With it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the volume is probably an issue, but then that goes back to, I mean, I think people have a compulsion issue across the board with a lot of things. So it's not just sexuality, it's not just porn, it's TikTok, it's eating. Like, there's this avoidance that we have to do difficult, hard things. And maybe some of it is we don't know what we're supposed to be doing, or there's a lack of purpose, lack of connection. So instead of sitting with that discomfort or that almost kind of purgatory, you're like, I'm just going to do the thing that feels good. So whether that thing is sexual, whether that thing is eating, whether that thing is mindlessly watching a screen or a TikTok. So I think that that's one version of a symptom of a much bigger problem. So it's if you have these high school kids, and probably boys way more than girls as far as this being an issue, it's okay, how do you channel that energy? Because if you do believe that sex and that kind of root chakra is a creative energy, instead of trying to extinguish it, you say, how do we transmute this into something that can turn into something more beneficial? So maybe you start jujitsu, maybe I give, like, what are you into? Let's start a business, let me walk you through actually creating this idea and bringing it into reality. Because you see these kids that have TikTok shops, and I started this nonprofit, or right? They can do really incredible things even if they're teenagers. So you take that energy that's there, and for a boy, it's probably a lot, and you move it into something else.
Yes.
And the problem is, as we mentioned, parents not having time and not being involved. That might be true for some people, but I think a lot of people, they're just checked out. A lot of parents are also checked out. And that's why when you ask a kid, what do you want to do? And they go, I don't know. They're not used to being asked questions.
No.
So they don't know how to answer it. They're not going home and their parent isn't like, what it was the most interesting part of your day today? What was the hardest part of your day today? What was the most inspiring part of your day today? And actually listening, not having your phone in the other hand, not like daydreaming and just checking out. So they're not engaged in even their own lives because of this. So yeah, porn is a problem, but it's more a symptom of a bigger root cause. So you can keep trying to approach it with make it illegal, these people are bad. It's going to turn into something else. It's going to turn into them doing drugs or eating too much or becoming depressed. It's the symptom is going to change. You're not going to get rid of the problem. So I think people have to be so careful about just blankly blaming one group of people or one thing, because it's just lazy thinking. It's like on the other side too, right? If everything is because of Trump, well, you're not a serious thinker, because if the answer to all of your problems can't be Trump. And the same on the other side, the answer to all of your problems can't be porn. So let's get to, do we want to solve this or not? Do we want to have a serious conversation or not? And I think most people care about kids, want them to do better, want them to thrive, want them to you see the amounts of like suicide and depression and anxiety and body dysmorphia. Those, no one feels good about that. Yeah. So how do we actually tackle this in a real way?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, parents don't know their kids. I ask those kids that I ask their parents then. They don't. I love getting to know my kids. It's so much fun just asking them questions. Like it's the most rewarding thing I have in my life, probably. I mean, it's incredible. Just like this gift of getting to know this person as they develop. But the cheap short-term dopamine hits. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it goes for food and stuff like that. And I talk about food and stuff like that a lot too. I guess where I think sex is different is, and this makes you sound like a real conservative, but it's like, it's designed to create life. And I worry about the act that's designed. Life seems like a really precious, important thing. So to take that for listen, like, yes, I know that we have abortion, we have birth control and stuff like that. But like, I'm law wise, I'm pro-choice, but I still think I've had four different podcasts with, I had an abortion doctor on, I had a woman who went through an abortion, is now pro-life. I've had a pro-life feminist. I've had a medical student who wants to give abortions and stuff like that. Like, I'm very curious about it, but I don't know. I don't think it's, again, the ideal. So let's not aim for this idea of like, well, if I get pregnant, then I'll just take care of it. I guess that's where I see sex as a little bit different. I hear you, and I'm on board with you with all of this stuff. But that's why I guess I see sex a little bit different. I think the ramifications are, you're creating life, and that seems like a really important thing.
And that's a serious. No. That is obviously a very serious thing to consider, especially if you're a woman. But we're also not taught that you can only get pregnant, like there's only a chance of you getting pregnant 6 days a week.
Yeah.
So if you believe in intelligent design, which I do, and I love that theory. I sent you that Sheldon clip. I think it's just so wonderful. If you believe in intelligent design and everything is for a purpose, then you wouldn't, especially as a woman, you wouldn't have an organ and strictly for pleasure. Right? Men don't have it. You don't have a single thing on your body that is strictly for pleasure. Women have something that is strictly for pleasure. And then if that was only to create life, that thing would only be turned on 6 days a month. 6 days a month, because you're incentivized, because there is this, before organized religion, there is this idea, and the French call it the climax, the little death. So the little death is the death of the ego. So it's in that moment of peak pleasure. You have transcended identity, and there's now this merge that's happening. And that merge is not only with the person that you're having sex with, but it's with God. It's with the universe. It is like you are transcended out of this 3D and you become something so much bigger than you are. So yes, I think sex can be spiritual, but I don't think that that means that it necessarily needs to be within one specific container. Is it different? And is that valuable? Yes, marriage is immensely valuable. Monogamy is immensely valuable. It's not what I'm saying, but it's saying that to just challenge the idea that sex is only for procreation, because there's so many design things that it's like, maybe not, because back then it was like sodomy was anything but sex for a baby.
Right.
So I think most of us agree that that should be allowed. That's not a problem, especially even if you were married, that would have been a no-no.
Yeah. No, and I didn't mean that it's only. I've heard that being said, like the only reason. That's not what I'm saying. It is playing with like, if women don't know their bodies and they don't know if they're ovulating or not, like, which a lot of young girls, they don't know anything about their bodies.
Which is so sad.
You're still playing with, you're rolling the dice to some degree with something that seems very, very important, very big, you know. I mean, that I guess that's it. But
no, yeah, and I agree, and I think that those guardrails need to be a lot tighter on people that are younger, right? I think when you get older, you can kind of expand what do you want to play around with. But I think when you're young, you don't have the capabilities to understand the full gravity of any of those decisions, so it should be taken seriously. But I'm talking more like college, post college, that kind of thing. I think those rules are very different. I mean, in high school, it's terrifying. It's terrifying to think about. Yeah.
Yeah. Girls don't know their own bodies. Guys don't. I mean, there are kids, and I've taught kids who will not talk about sex with their partner, but they'll have sex with their partner. Like, that's the kind of stuff that's like weird. Like,
they're ready for it then. Yeah.
What they like, what they don't like. Like, that's the stuff that's so taboo. The thing about like porn industry is like, you just don't talk about it. Everyone's looking at it. Everyone knows it exists, but no one's talking about it. That's the thing that I want to be able to like get it out in the surf. So thank you for talking to me about this, because I think that's important to like, putting it out there. You know, my wife read some book about sexual stuff when she was like going through something. It was really interesting. She's like, they're learning stuff. She's like, do you know how many women probably have never like, sorry, this, not, I don't know, be crude for you, but like your audience, but like, you know, like looked at their like private parts, like in a mirror, like really like look at
you.
Like,
not a lot.
Not a lot. Like middle-aged women have never done that ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. So you don't even know your own body. Like, shouldn't you know your own body? It goes back to like we were saying about these tests and stuff like that. Knowing who you are inside and out, physically, emotionally, mentally, it just seems like that should be a really, really important part of the way that education happens. Probably not ideally in a school, but no. You know, but like promoted by however kids are getting educated, hopefully by their homes or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then our educators will be, well, if they're not doing it at the house, then it's our job. And it's like, no, not necessarily. That's not how it works.
Get out the hand mirror, ladies.
Yeah, they're not your kids. And you should be able to, you can disagree with how people raise their kids. Because I've heard that too from certain administrators where they're like, well, the kid will come and they'll say something. And I know that's not them. I know that that's their parent talking. Okay, move on.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not your job to do that. No, that's a big thing for sure.
No. This has been awesome. I don't want to take too much of your time, but before we wrap it up, do you want to tell people where they can follow you, how they can support you, projects you're working on, all that good stuff?
Yeah, thank you. So I really enjoyed this conversation. I really did. I don't know if it was interesting to your audience. I apologize if it wasn't, but I really enjoyed it. So just my name, Will Rouge. that's on Instagram, but Instagram's the platform that I use for social media. And then William Reusch is my, I just have a website, William Reusch, R-E-U-S-C-H.com. And that's going to be the place where I'm going to have all of my homeschool curriculum and stuff like that, starting with U.S. history class, all applicable stuff. I'm not going to teach a single thing from history that you can't apply right now as a 16-year-old and then apply going out into the world. And then I'm also going to be teaching a civics class. And I'm trying to do something, all the stuff that we're talking about, Ken, it's like, I'm trying to do something that's scalable. I love that you're doing an Apogee school. I love that. I was still dealing with like the bandwidth issue of, I only have 25 kids in front of me. How can I scale good education? If you're a good teacher, then how, let's get you as many students as possible. So it's something I'm playing with, and I really appreciate your audience checking it out, giving me pushback, giving me feedback and stuff like that. I really, thank you so much for giving me this platform.
Oh my gosh, of course. Anytime, I'd love to have you back on. I think it's so important. I think creating content is a great way to do exactly that and scale something that in the past hasn't been scalable. And I think that's how you create changes, through competition. So keep doing your thing. I love it. I'll keep following you and support you throughout your journey. And I appreciate you.
Same, Candace. Same.
Well, that's it for this week's episode of Chatting with Candace. If you enjoyed the episode, please share it with a friend or two. Leave that 5-star review. And if you comment something nice, maybe I will read it on the next episode. And again, if you want to support the podcast, go to chattingwithcandace.com and check out all of the links below. Thank you, everybody. And I'll see you next time. Bye.